A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
You're out of order! You're out of order! The whole trial is out of order!
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete!
Lose! I don't lose! I win! I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do!
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Comedians at Law podcast, episode number 70. I'm your host this week, Matt Ritter, and with me as a special guest fill-in, we have Joan Weisblatt.
Hi, everybody.
How you doing, Joan?
I'm great, Matt. How are you?
I am excellent. I am excited because we have a big week. We have our big Arizona show coming up at Stand Up Live in Phoenix, Thursday, January 30th at 8 o'clock, and looks like we've got a huge turnout expected. We've got one of the assistant deans of the law school doing a guest spot. She's a lawyer comedian. Her name's Nancy Stanley.
Wow.
And we've got a local area comic named Bob Howard. So if you're in the Phoenix area, or if you know anybody in the Phoenix area, tell them to come check us out.
Excellent. That sounds great. And I'm going to be at the Giggle Pit in the East Village in New York City tomorrow night at 6, and on Tuesday at the Full Cup in Staten Island at 9.
So we've got the whole country covered this week.
Absolutely. Kansas is a problem. That's the only place I think we're not quite there.
So, yeah, we have to figure out a way to get to Kansas. That's by train, I think, is the easiest.
Pick our heels together like Dorothy.
Yeah, we'll get there. Well, I don't want to be there during hurricane season.
Well said.
So it's been an interesting week. As always, I feel like, you know, it's so easy for us to get the stories really write themselves.
Yes, they do.
You know, should we jump in? We have some great stories this week. Let's just jump right into them.
Okay, sounds good.
Since when has the paragon of investigative journalism allowed lawyers to determine the news content?
This first story, not too surprising. U.S. News and World Report does a ranking of the top 100 jobs in the nation based on factors like expected openings, advancement opportunities, career fulfillment, and salary expectations. If you just had to guess, you probably already looked at it, but if you had to guess before looking at this chart, where would you expect lawyer to fall?
Most likely dead last.
You would have thought that, really dead last out of 100 jobs?
Having been a lawyer for 30 years, I would say dead last.
Well, you're not too far off. We came in at number 50 this year, which is a drop from 35. I think at some point, maybe 20, 30 years ago, we were in the top 10. But now we are ranked pretty low, and we're also number 4 on the I like this ranking. 5 dream jobs that aren't so dreamy.
Yes. Well, there were at least 100 jobs I could think of that would have been more satisfying than practicing law, but that's me.
Well, what's interesting about this list is there are some that you'd be surprised are ranked higher, I think. I'll give you a couple of examples. Now, you tell me if you agree this is a better or worse than being a lawyer. A nail technician?
Well, I'll tell you, interestingly, when I was deciding what to do with my life, those were my two choices, lawyer or nail technician.
You made the wrong choice.
I made the wrong choice.
But also, I mean, I feel like nail technician isn't it kind of like harmful toxins all the time in there?
I suppose so. But if your nails look great, the price of beauty can be quite high.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. I personally, I would choose law over nail technician because I hate the smell of nail polish.
And how often do you get your nails done? Let's be honest.
Well, my sister drags me to the mani and pedi every time I'm in New York. That's our thing. That's our little secret.
Oh, that's very cute.
Yeah, but I don't have my nails done because I'm a nail biter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. How about this one? This is another job that ranked higher than lawyer. You tell me whether you'd rather. Maintenance repairman.
Yes, I would much rather have been a maintenance repair person because this is the point. When you're a maintenance repair person, you start with something that's broken and you fix it. When you're a lawyer, you start with something that's broken and you either break it more or try to repair it and it never is quite right.
Yeah, or sometimes you take something that isn't really broken and you break it.
Good point.
Well, you definitely charge for it, even though it didn't really need any work.
How about you, Matt? What would you rather have done?
Well, I like that the idea that sometimes, you know, single women call over a handyman and sleep with them. You know, I don't think that happens too much in the legal profession, except if you're a divorce lawyer.
You know, I now that you bring that up, I can think of so many handymen that I've slept with. It's really quite true.
Yeah. And did you actually have a job for them, or was it kind of like you could have done it yourself?
It was an ostensible tile job.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of grouting, but mostly it was mostly just for sexual.
Yeah, I was the one who got tiled.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking, you know, if I was a divorce lawyer, maybe I'd rather do that. Because, like, remember Arnie Becker from L.A. Law? He seemed to do pretty well.
He did. He did. Now, gynecologist, I'm not so sure. But certainly Arnie Becker, yes.
Yeah, yeah, I know. So I think I probably would rather be a handyman. I like doing handiwork. It's enjoyable.
Yes. You have a feeling of accomplishment.
Yeah. I've never had a feeling of accomplishment in the law.
No.
Although some lawyers probably do. If you're a big litigator and you win a big case, there's probably some feeling. That's probably the equivalent of, like, you know, changing a light bulb.
Right. But those jobs are few and far between and harder to get these days. So thus the dissatisfaction.
Now, here's one I take issue with. This one came in at 29 on the list. Esthetician, which is a hot field these days. I'm not even really clear on exactly what they do.
It's a pimple popper.
Right. Okay. So I am clear on what it is. Now, I find that to be a pretty undesirable job.
I don't know. Well, you know what? I agree with you, but I like to be the recipient, but not the giver.
I love when my girlfriend pops my zits, especially the ones on my derriere, shall we say.
Ah, how tasty.
Those are the hard to reach places. You know, I know very few people who can pop their own rear end zits.
No, I find them hard to reach myself.
But I mean, seriously, do estheticians have to do that? I don't even know how it works.
No, they don't pop pimples on your behind. No. Oh,
is that like even if you pay them a little extra?
Well, I've never had that experience, not having pimples on my rear end. But I think if you pay them extra, they'd be willing to do it.
You know, to me, that's a tough job. I don't know. You really have to have the stomach for it.
Yes, I agree.
You would rather be what, a lawyer or esthetician?
I would like to be an anesthetician. Ah. I would like to be out while I'm popping somebody else's pimple.
You'd like to be able to put yourself out while doing it.
Exactly.
So you can't feel a thing.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. It just strikes me as you're just really up close and personal with people in a way that I'm not really interested in doing that. I'd rather suffer through being a corporate. I'd rather suffer through going back to my corporate law job than getting involved in people's just pores. That whole region is gross.
It's true. It's true. And having a job where you have to talk to people constantly is, for me, that would be difficult.
Yes. I'm not a small talk guy. So that's really, that's why, you know, I mean, that's, I hated law, dinners, you know, those dinners where you're stuck between two people you hate and it's like a 3.5 hour meal.
Right. Talking about things that don't interest you but might interest somebody else.
Yeah. But it seems to me esthetician is a constant stream of chit chat and zit popping. That's a bad combo.
That's true. Although I've never had an English speaking esthetician, so it really hasn't been much of a problem.
So, yeah, it's not really. It's more of a first generation kind of job.
Exactly.
Now, this one, I think you go either way. Massage therapist, I would say I would rather be a massage therapist than a lawyer.
No, I would rather be an esthetician than a massage therapist.
Are you not into that, the rubdowns?
Well, I'm into getting them. I'm just not into giving them.
I don't mind. Every now and then I like to give a good massage. It's a feeling of accomplishment when you get like a good knot out and somebody's back.
Well, that's fine. But the problem is that you don't get to pick who you're customers are. So
yeah, no, I would like to have a selective, you know. Yeah, that's true. You know, why isn't it that way? It should be the other way around, where there should be a masseuse who gets to choose his clients.
Exactly. That's the kind I want to be. I would definitely do that over being a lawyer.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that we're at number 50, but You think we'll get to 100 out of 100? Yeah, obviously, you guessed that we were going to be 100. You really think we will end up dead last, ultimately?
It depends on, you know, in all seriousness, it depends on the job market. If things don't get any better, we may be sinking fast.
I mean, there's nothing lower than document review. So if you were just talking about that, I would say, yeah, that's 100 out of 100.
There you go.
All right, should we move on to our next? That's just not surprising that we're at 50, but and plummeting. Should we move on to our next story?
Sure.
You want to tee this one up, the Huckabee story?
Absolutely. So Mike Huckabee, who is a former Republican candidate for president, gave a speech this week to the Republican National Committee. And the purpose of giving the speech was to encourage the closing of the gender gap in the Republican Party. And unfortunately for him, what ended up happening was that he gave a speech which angered women to the point that I'm not sure that any woman will now vote for him or for anybody in the Republican Party. Basically, what he said was that companies should, well, I think what his point was that companies should not be forced to purchase insurance whereby the employees will get a non-copay birth control. But the way that he put it was that women need to learn to control their overactive libidos and their reproductive systems and not count on the government, aka Uncle Sugar, to provide them with birth control.
Some crazy stuff out of it. I mean, it's literally like he's been frozen in time, like he was cryogenically frozen and he woke up and he thinks it's 1950.
Exactly. But he also has an audience that agrees with him, which to me is the scariest part.
You know what's scary to me is the people that are listening that agree with him, don't they have wives? And what do those wives think?
Yeah. And also, not to mention, if you're an employer, don't you want your employees using birth control that they can afford? You want them to use birth control. Otherwise, they get knocked up and they leave, right?
I've never understood the argument in any respect, morally, economically. It doesn't make sense to say, hey, we don't want you to be responsible.
Well, I agree with you about that. And if your reasoning is that the Bible says that you don't, that you're not supposed to use birth control, that you're supposed to be fruitful and multiply, I guess you can always rely on that. But that's about as far as it goes.
You know, the thing that drives me crazy, I got to say, is this idea that you can, I hate the way, it's sort of backwards, the way that employers are now saying, hey, we don't want to provide them with this right because we have a right to uphold our morals and affect them negatively.
Right.
It's crazy.
It is. It is. But you know what? A lot of people buy into that. So,
but the idea that your morals, it's just the bigger question in this country is, how is it possible for you to look in the mirror and say, I have the moral right to hurt others?
Well, I don't think that they look at it that way. I think they think that they have the moral right to help others, to rescue others, and to protect others. So I don't know if we're ever going to come to an understanding about this.
I just think, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to, it's sort of like a legal thing, you shouldn't be allowed to cause externalities with your morals.
Right, I agree.
You should be allowed to have your morals when they're within the framework of exist everybody's day-to-day live and let live kind of thing.
Right. That makes sense. And that's why it's interesting that libertarians frequently take that position. And that seems to make sense to me. That's a more consistent position.
Yeah. It's very inconsistent if you are on that side of like the quasi-libertarian position, except when it comes to a woman's body.
Yes, exactly. Then all of a sudden all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. Are they not going to, you know, I mean, it's just crazy too, because, you know, it's one thing, it's so far down the line. It's one thing to say, hey, on moral grounds, you know, we don't want to pay for abortions, but to not pay for birth control, you know, you're taking such a hard line there.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, it seems to me that this is an argument that's only been made in the last, 20, 30 years. Before that, well, you know, you weren't alive then, but I certainly was. I don't remember this kind of thing ever having been an issue, but the religious right has gotten such a stronghold in politics that and doesn't let go, and this is what we have as a result.
Yeah, what I thought was despicable too is that there are some hot, I think it was it Kansas, where there's some doctors who are pharmacists that if it goes against their morals, they don't have to give you the birth control prescription, even if there's no other pharmacist available in the area.
Exactly.
I mean, this is lunacy.
Mm-hmm. Can you imagine a pharmacist telling you whether or not you should use birth control?
Oh.
Tell you that they won't provide you with birth control?
Listen, with the rampant sex I had in my 20s, if this rule was in place then, I'd be in big trouble.
I would have been pregnant 200,000 times.
Yeah, it would have been real messy. And the other thing is, you know, it's like a catch-22. They then go, hey, there's all these unwed mothers that we don't want to support. We shouldn't. Our government shouldn't have to support. But we won't let you, protect yourself from getting pregnant.
But God will provide.
God will provide. God. Praise the Lord. Listen,
Lord, I
don't have a problem with religion. I don't want anyone to think I do. I just think religion has to sort of fit in with reality.
Right. It has its place in our lives.
It has to fit in with the realities of the world. And the realities are women are allowed to have sex freely. Sorry, Huckabee.
Yes.
And they should be encouraged to have sex freely.
You know, this may be a deep-seated problem with him because maybe he didn't get any when he was younger and now he regrets it.
Yeah, he doesn't want anyone else to have a taste.
Right.
I think that's probably it. He probably did. He was a chubby kid.
He was.
He lost like 300 pounds, so I could see him now being like, you know, no girls even talk to me, so now I want no women to have sex.
Although he looks like he's on the uptick again, so that may contribute to it also.
Man, people love him.
Go figure.
Go figure. I don't get it. I'd love to get some interaction with our fans on this one. What do you guys think about this? I mean, do you think these states and these doctors and these pharmacists should have, and these employers should have any right to stand on moral grounds and deny birth control? Tweet us at #CALPod. I'd love to hear what you think about that. It's all the same, like birth control, Plan B. I think it should all be readily available.
I agree.
Otherwise, it's going to be a bad problem for us.
We're of the same mind.
Yeah. Should we move on to our last story? This is an uplifting one.
Yes.
Oh, Stephen Hawking. This is, I always find him to be very cynical, and he's kind of a Debbie Downer. He's always talking about how, you know, there is no God and there is no afterlife, and we're just in a universe that's gonna explode one day. But now he's backtracked a little. He's showing a little optimism. He recently said that the black holes that he always talks about are not inescapable.
Yes,
he's saying that there's an apparent horizon which only holds matter. We used to think of a black hole as you get sucked in and poof, you're gone.
Yes,
now he's saying you could get out.
Isn't that something? But what I find most fascinating about Stephen Hawking is that he's still here to talk about it. Because here's a man that has ALS, and he has had it for, I don't know, 40 years. And every time he is back on the air again, I say, wow, that guy is still around? Well, good for him.
Yeah, he's going to outlast us all. He's going to figure out a way to turn himself into a computer program.
It sounds like a Twilight Zone episode.
Oh, totally. But here's the other thing about him, and I kind of joke about this. I have a bit about it. Whether you believe in God or not, if anybody has a reason to not believe in God, it's the guy who God took a complete dump on.
Right. And he's the epitome of that.
I could see him really having a bone to pick with God.
Yes.
I mean, he really gave him a raw deal.
Yeah, he really got all the bad stuff, but still he maintains his optimism. Well, maybe not so much before, but now he's softened his black hole theory. I always thought a black hole was something else, but now I understand what it is, having read the article.
What did you think it was?
Oh, well, maybe we shouldn't go there.
I know what you thought it was. It is that as well, but
yes,
we're talking science here.
Yes, I guess getting my mind off of sex sometimes is pretty difficult. But
no, I listen, we're talking science right now. It's very non-sexual You know, I've never really understood the galaxy. Every time I read one of these quantum theory books, I go, oh, I get it. I get it. And then my friends go, explain it to me. I go, oh, you just got to read the book.
You can't do it. No.
I can't.
No, but yeah, I think what you have to do is just throw words around so that people think you know what you're talking about.
Like, I say quark a lot.
Quark. I say string theory all the time.
If you say quark and string theory in the same paragraph, you sound like a genius.
You do. You do.
Also, a big word to sound smart is a singularity.
Ah, singularity. Sustainability. That's another good one.
Yeah. I think the problem with Hawking is too, though, he's too smart. It's like he needs somebody half as smart as him to relay all this stuff to us dummies.
Well, that's so interesting that you should say that, because what's been so great about Stephen Hawking all these years, maybe up until now, is that he's made these things more understandable to the general public, the you and me. But I have to say, it's still a little bit over my head.
Yeah, I think he needs some sort of second in command to kind of relay, dumb it down even further.
Yes.
In layman's terms. But this is good news. I mean, you know, in 10,000 years, when we get sucked into a black hole, maybe a million years later, we might get popped out. We might get pooped right out. It's sort of like, when your dog eats something bad and you're wondering if it's just going to get digested, and then it gets pooped out a couple days later and you can breathe easier.
Yes. There's light at the end of the tunnel, and that's a good thing.
Yeah. So the universe might poop us back out. And so for our, you know, for whoever's listening to this podcast in the year 4050, maybe we'll pop right back out.
God, we have solved the world's problems tonight, haven't we?
I think we may have. Yeah. Should we hit up the Twitter feed?
Sounds good.
Let's do it. We have, let's see here. We've got some love here. We got some love from Marie Claire. We've got Reg Levy retweeted us and tweeted at us some gobbledygook. I'm not really sure what they were saying there. Dr. Cynthia Howard followed us.
Yes.
Thomas Terrence retweeted us. And then we got a bunch of followers. Michael Lancaster, Amy Bresnan, Fractal Hedge, Robert Lemus, New York City Live Music. Stand Up Live has been tweeting about our show. A lawyer named Tim Ego is tweeting about our shows in Phoenix. Tommy Gooch and the Hoger. And looks like...
Do you know Tommy Gooch and the Hoger? I know those guys.
No. Who are they?
Yeah, they're both comedians. They're New York comedians. In fact, I just did a show with the Hoger on Friday night. Good guy.
Well, that's nice. That's nice for them to support
us. Great guy, too.
And we've got some School of Law 101, Sobia Talks, ABA Tips Skulls, Danny and Penta. We got a lot of new followers. I mean, we're killing it this week.
We are almost famous.
Ellis Carter, Remy Alaboul, Johnny's Hideaway, the best dance club in the South. Wow, we're doing really well.
We are.
Yeah, Ellis Carter looks like she's in Phoenix, so hopefully we'll see her at the show. Mm-hmm. This was a good week. We have an interview coming up that I'm doing with the Vandy SBA rep. We were down there for a show, so he's talking to us. This was great talking to you this week, Joan. Great podcast.
Wonderful. Wonderful talking to you too, Matt. I loved it. Thank you.
All right, thanks. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Comedians at Law podcast. We have a very special guest coming up. He is an SBA and ABA rep at Vanderbilt Law School. He's a third year. He's heading to New York to work for a big firm over at Milbank. Welcome to the podcast, Alex Gefter.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we were just down at Vandy, and thank you for having us. We had a great time down there.
It was our pleasure. It's just our time down now, and we've enjoyed it every time. So hopefully you guys are going to keep on coming back. It was a great show.
Yeah, you guys are pretty much our most favorite school at this point, I would say.
Yeah, well, we feel the same way. We're a pretty good place to be. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, Vandy just, it just seems like a very, you know, we've been to a lot of schools. What do you think makes Vandy, it seems like a very close-knit close-knit atmosphere over there for the law school. Why do you think that is? And do you agree with that?
I definitely agree with that. That was one of the reasons that I actually came to Vanderbilt. I was looking at a lot of schools. You know, I'm from New York originally, so it was a big move to come down here. And, you know, without trying to sound too trite or cliched, one of the things that really drew me was the collegiality of the school. That's a really small student body. I think our during class is like 170, 175 this past year. So, I mean, you're talking about an entire school that has, you know, 550 kids or so, sometimes a little bit less. I mean, there's other schools that actually, that's one class. So by virtue of that, you just know, you know, most of your classmates, if you so choose. The professors are just really open and welcoming. I mean, literally kind of a doors open policy. It was just one of those experiences, you know, when I was visiting schools, the people I met here, both the students and the other kind of perspectives, you know, I really clicked. And I thought it was just it was a great place to be. It's a nice environment to go to school. So, so far, so good.
You know, I'm from New York as well. Is there something particularly Southern about Vanderbilt? And if so, what is that element? What is that Southern element? Like, describe it to us, those of us who haven't gone to law school in the South.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think, you know, the biggest Southern thing about Vanderbilt is, frankly, it's probably not even Vanderbilt itself. It's probably just the very fact that it's in Nashville, Tennessee. I mean, as far as Southern cities go, it's fairly cosmopolitan. But, I mean, you still have lots of honky-tonks and kind of all that somewhat stereotypical stuff that people relate with the South. And also, I think, just kind of the environment of the school. You know, you have this very kind of lush campus. You know, everything's kind of just a little bit slower. Kind of the pace of life all around town is a little bit slower than, you know, New York, for instance, or Boston or Philadelphia. You know, any of the big, you know, seaboard-type cities on the East Coast. And I think kind of all of those things combined give it that, you know, Southern charm, so to speak.
And do you, I mean, do you find that there was a lot of other people from all over that went to Vandy Law School, or were you kind of the exception being from New York?
You know, they do a pretty good job of trying to get students from all over the country. I think that's a real focus on their recruitment because, you know, they want to be known that they a national school of national reach. Obviously, because it is such a good school, particularly in the Southeast, you're sort of disproportionately favoring students from things like Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama. But at the same time, I have a lot of friends from all over the country, from the Northeast, from the West Coast, from Texas. So they do a pretty good job of, you know, trying, like I said, trying to recruit across the country. And job placements the same way. I mean, four of my closest friends are going to San Francisco, Chicago, and D.C. and Houston, respectively. So, you know, you sort of get a little of everything, which is nice. You get a little variety, especially for a class as small as we are.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I also thought what was really cool is the Friday night Blackacre drinks. How did that come about? Was that a recent thing, or is that just like a Vandy tradition?
You know, as far as I know, that's been going on for like decades. That was going on well before I got here, and it's pretty fun. I mean, I think that goes to sort of the kind of collegial atmosphere of the school. I think the school tries to not take itself too seriously, and so just for the listeners, the Blackacre is basically every single Friday a student organization brings in a couple of kegs of beer, sometimes wine if they want to be classy, you know, some food, and people just get a chance to, you know, hang out and unwind after a long week, and that's a pretty interesting and unique kind of thing, and that kind of helps bring the student body together. I mean, you got, you know, 100, 150 kids that go pretty much every single week, so it's kind of, you know, good reception. And so that's, you know, that's just kind of said, kind of speaks to the nature of the school a little bit, and yeah, I mean, it's a blast. You know, who can be complaining about free beer and physical?
Yeah. Do the professors ever join in?
They do. You know, basically, the invite's always open to the entire school. Professors will occasionally pop their heads in, particularly if, you know, often the Blackacre will be sponsored by a law firm or something like that. That's where you get the really fancy food. And so they'll come especially to those. During the week, I mean, it's just a matter of kind of timing. I think because it's Friday at the end of the day, the professors don't really want to be here any more than we do. So a lot of them by, you know, by 4:30 on Friday are already out the door. But, I mean, pretty much every single Blackacre, there's at least one or two that you'll see hanging out for a bit. Which is pretty nice. I mean, you don't see that too often. The professors kind of hang out and we'll have a beer with the student.
Yeah, that's really cool. I forget what Blackacre is in the legal jargon, but I remember hating it. Some sort of property. There was like, yeah, Blackacre, Whiteacre, or some sort of property thing. And so you're heading up to New York to work. Do you, is the sort of environment really stressful right now for law students, though, just in terms of the job search?
I think overall, I mean, it's a tough time. Obviously, it's better than it was, you know, 2-3 years ago, right during kind of the peak of the crisis there. But I think it's still a stressful time. I mean, hiring is not, probably not ever likely to bounce back to that, you know, 2007 levels. And, you know, with that, I think there's just there's a lot of competition for the jobs that are out there. For better or worse, most applications have dropped pretty substantially in the last couple of years, which sort of offsets a little bit of that competition. You know, there's less applicants in the school, and so...
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, hopefully we'll get back to the equilibrium, you know, where it's the right amount of people in school for the market.
Right, and that's the hope. I mean, I personally, I don't think we're there yet, so there is some competition. But I think, you know, people are working hard to get jobs. And it depends, you know, what school you go to be honest. I think Vanderbilt overall was doing fairly decently. I mean, not everyone's getting their first choice, but, you know, at least from most of the 3Ls that I've spoken with in career services, you know, the majority of the classes, you know, either had a job lined up or is considering some opportunities. So it seems like, you know, it's going the right way. But, I mean, it's a tough market. That's just the truth of the matter. I mean, that's for just everybody out there.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be hard to talk to people who don't have jobs, though. It's got to be just hard to kind of converse with friends at other law schools or even in your own law school that don't have jobs.
Yeah, no, it really is. And in part because there's not really any, there's no kind of matching campuses out there. I mean, if you wanted a big fun job, pretty much you need to have stellar grades, 1-0 a year. And the only way to, you know, get a big fun job if you didn't do that is, you know, through some kind of nepotism. Or, frankly, getting a little bit lucky later on. And so the truth is, you know, there's, it's hard to, you know, really give advice or talk about it because there's not, you know, there's always something you can really do at the end of the day. I mean, a lot of it is just, you know, like career services, always telling us, you know, networking and things like that. And so it's tough, but I think people are, in general, whether they do or don't have jobs, sort of cognizant of how everybody else is doing. And so as long as you're not the jerk that's rubbing your job in their face, I think everyone's pretty friendly about it.
Yeah, I think there was a Facebook post about that last year. Somebody was rubbing their job in their classmate's face, but sounds like everybody at Vandy's doing okay. Did you think that in terms of the interview process, did you think SBA work actually helped or not really?
I mean, it's one of those things where it definitely didn't hurt. I think in my case, I don't know if it's unique, but Vanderbilt's a pretty young law school, so we have a pretty high percentage of the kids that go straight through, and I worked for about 4 years before law school, so most of my interviews focused pretty heavily on my past work experience because I was in finance and I'm a paralegal for a little bit, so I could talk about a little bit more than just, you know, what my favorite class was, contracts or CIPRO or something.
Yeah.
But in general, from speaking to my classmates, I think any sort of extracurricular activities that you can get involved in, whether that's, you know, moot court or mock trial or something like SBA, it's just kind of another thing you can talk about to your benefit.
Yeah, but you think working actually was the big leg up for you?
I think it was. Yeah, I think it really helped a lot. I mean, I had a lot more to talk about, and the conversation was frankly just a lot more interesting. I think when you have that kind of work experience, and this might not necessarily be true, but I think there's a perception, at least among hiring partners and the like, that you can kind of hit the ground running just a little bit better than somebody else. And just the economy being what it is, you know, they want to have that first year who can do just a little bit more work so they don't have to justify billing his hours out, you know, to where the client is.
Yeah.
So for me, yeah,
Were we right during the show in thinking that everybody knows everybody's business over there at your school personally?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's like high school all over again.
yeah, they certainly seem to know who is hooking up with who.
Oh, absolutely. There's a couple of the secret couples in the audience, too. I didn't want to call them out, but they were there. They didn't want to say it.
Yeah, I posted that clip online, actually. That was a really good one. That was a good time. You know, we had a great time. You know, that game we played, the little mock interview game, seemed to be really, really a hit. So we're definitely looking forward to coming back to Vandy next year, even though you won't be there.
Well, you know what? Maybe I'll come back for the visit.
Yeah, very nice. Well, good luck to you, you know, on the bar, obviously, and, you know, in your future as a big firm lawyer.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
So that wraps up our podcast for this week. Thank you guys for tuning in. And just to let you know, we may have some big changes coming up on the podcast, so stay tuned for that. Thanks for listening.